Hi, and welcome to the Prodcast, your fix for everything innovative in advertising and production. I'm Pat Murphy, and I've been working in this industry for more than 35 years now. I've seen a lot of changes, but trust me, there's plenty more around the corner. Each week on the podcast, you'll hear from one of the movers and shakers shaping the world of advertising and production for the future. And we'll dive into some of the key challenges facing our sector today and how we're best placed to overcome them. Today, we're talking to someone who sits right at the intersection of production, technology, AI, and global transformation. Mark Knowles, Global Solutions Officer at Dentsu. Mark has spent his career building the systems, workflows, and technologies that power some of the world's biggest brands. At Dentsu and TAG, he's been instrumental in developing AI-enabled production ecosystems, connected content engines, and high-velocity workflows that are reshaping how global content gets made. He's one of the clearest thinkers in our industry on what AI actually means for production. Not the hype, but the operational reality. And he's a passionate advocate for the people, craft, and intelligence that sits behind the great work. Mark, thanks so much for joining me on the podcast.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Pat. Thanks for having me.
That's a big build up there.
It was. I hope I can deliver on that.
I have... One first question that starts right at the beginning, which is, what's your title this week?
My title this week? Oh, my goodness. It's Global Solutions Officer, which is relatively all-encompassing.
Yeah. You keep changing your title. What are you actually? Are you a creative technologist, a producer, a transformation specialist, just an anorak? How would you describe yourself?
That's a great question. I ask myself that often. Basically, I work with clients to kind of figure out some of their biggest problems and really come up with solutions that help them connect a lot of dots, right, is the best way of describing it. So lots of conversations, lots of trying to keep up with the pace of things, and lots of transformation. So it's an exciting role. It's never the same.
Now, you started right at the very beginning, right on the ground floor, and then you've kind of worked your way up. How did you actually get into the business for the benefits of young people coming into the industry? Where did you start and how did it grow?
That is a great question. So interestingly enough, I never knew that I wanted to go to university when I was at college in the UK. And then all my friends started going and I just started looking around to see what was out there. And I was always really interested in the kind of combination of practical things and technical things. And sort of anything on the computer seemed like a little bit of a forte at the time. And I was just thumbing through the prospectus of the University of Portsmouth, funnily enough, and they had this computer animation course. And I was looking at it and I was just fascinated by it. And, you know, at that time, it was kind of the rise of Pixar, and like one of my favorite movies was Robots, was like the thing at the time. And I just loved the sort of like richness of the world that they'd built. That was it. That was the start of it. And then once I'd graduated, funnily enough, it was a funny story. I'd applied for a company called Taylor James. And one of the reasons that I'd applied for them is that on their website, they had like these beautiful behind the scenes where you could go into the site and you could like swipe across all of the work in progresses. You could see the concept, the previs, the blah, blah, and you could swipe across all of them. And I just used to spend like hours on that. Anyway, applied for the job, didn't get it, right? So they rejected me the first time. And then I went to the Isle of Wight and started making computer games for a living, and then moved on from there and went back and applied for Taylor James again and finally got the job. And from there, it sort of was like, that was the accelerant, I think.
There's a learning there. It's like, don't give up, right?
Yes.
Persistence always pays off, right?
Oh my goodness, yeah, for sure. Because I would just, you know, what's really interesting is like you were asking about advice for people that are trying to get into the industry. I think that was really the learning curve for me, was like, if I'd have never gone back to Taylor James, I would never have been afforded any of the opportunities that I've had today, you know, especially when I moved over to the US to set up the Taylor James US operation with Glenn, who was the founder at the time. And it was just, that was just meteoric. And that was a huge accelerator for the acquisition by TAG as well. So yeah, just got to see so many things by persevering, you know.
And what have been the absolutely momentous moments during that path?
Oh my goodness. We did I'll never forget, one of the first jobs that I got when I went to Taylor James was we were doing a job for Rolex. They were sort of very anti-CGI at the time, but they really couldn't get the quality of the lighting that they wanted.
It's so weird because that's what they're known for, right?
Right now it is, right? It's, yeah. It's kind of crazy. So we'd done one of the first sort of full CG ads for them. And what they used to do is they used to put the watch on like a gimbal and they would just shine a light on it and they'd spin it round and they'd just run the camera, right? And then they would basically see what they got and cut it together in the edit. And they wanted this beautiful kind of like single camera fly through of the watch to show all of the different pieces of the watch. And what was really fascinating about it was that there were parts of the watch that they just hated. So like they would hate the oyster back on the back of the watch. They would hate some parts of the inside of the clasp. So they really wanted you never to show some of these things. But the cool thing was at the office, they'd sent us 9 watches that had to be locked in the safe every single day. And they were, I was doing modeling, texturing, lighting and shading in CG. And I had all of these watches on my desk and they were sort of like on my arm, at my ass, like looking. And I was like, that's the closest I'll ever become to get to a Rolex. But it was just kind of surreal, like the actual, like that was the first big job that I think I'd ever done. It was fun.
I was working on Rolex for J. Wolfe Thompson long time ago, and I was the producer, and I loved working on that account. And they had a thing in those days whereby if you worked on the account for 1 year, you got a free Rolex.
Oh my goodness,
right? And I missed it by a day.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So I never got my Rolex in the end. Oh, anyway, it was great fun to work on. Yeah. And we did some fantastic recces at the carnival in Venice and stuff like that. It was brilliant stuff. Nice client.
Beautiful work.
Yeah. So you're now the Global Solutions Officer at Dentsu.
Yes.
It's a title that sounds both exciting and somewhat mysterious. What does that actually mean? I know we talked about it a bit earlier, but does that mean, you know, you find it easy to solve Rubik's Cube, or what does it mean?
Do you know what? I'd love, like, if you talk about like superpowers, I'd love to be able to solve a Rubik's Cube. I sort of grew up through TAG, was the Chief Production Technology Officer at TAG. And then when we were acquired back in 2023 by Dentsu, it became very evident that there was a lot of opportunity to combine a lot of the Media Plus offerings. So Dentsu has this sort of Media Plus strategy, which is like Media Plus something else. So Media Plus content or CXM or creative or commerce, for example, or social. So really, I sit at the intersection of Media Plus something else. A lot of that focuses on Media Plus content, because one of the things that has sort of fascinated me throughout my career is that specifically at TAG, when we were an independent, we worked with all the agencies, right? But we never really got to see how the content performed. Like, how did it work? Like, we just made it and it went off into the world. And then you maybe see it on the big screen at some point, but you never really understood how it worked. And I think that has sort of really been fascinating for me, but also it's just something that the clients are asking us for all the time. So lots of that Media Plus content and the performance of that content is really interesting.
A TAG obviously is part of Dentsu. Yes. Are you still inside that building or are you somewhere else now?
No, we are. We've sort of rationalized all of our locations across the globe. And it's really nice because, again, the team is getting to see a side of the agency world that they've never seen before, especially being around like the creative teams as well, especially in our New York office. It's kind of exciting. So we've definitely done the rationalization piece.
And you're still in London or somewhere?
I'm in New York. So, yeah, I've been in New York for the last 14 years. Yeah, I have quite a wife and 2 kids. So I don't think there's any hope of me coming back. She refuses to drive on the other side of the road and she can't drive sticks. So we're not going to be doing that.
Look, you've been very clear publicly about avoiding the AI hype train.
Yes.
Inverted commas. Yeah. And focusing on operational AI.
Yeah.
Now, that's much further away from the stuff that you used to do when you were at Taylor James. I mean, how do you feel about that? I mean, the handshakes, the handoffs and the workflow, you know, how do you feel about all of that?
I think it's one of probably our biggest challenges as an industry. Everybody makes a digital banner or a TV ad or a social post, right? The reality is that we all do it differently. Every client's slightly different, and trying to create kind of a unified way of working is really challenging, especially when brands like, you know, back in the good old days, we had like 3 art buyers. We had a print art buyer, a digital art buyer, and a TV art buyer. Everything was very sort of like waterfall and it was all very clear. And now with this sort of like channel proliferation and explosion of different surfaces on which these brands have to talk, it's just made it really difficult. I'm a firm believer that like marketeers are not marketeers these days, right? Like they've become like button pushers, right? Like we expect them to go and spin up a schedule in like an MRM platform and they've got to go find things in the DAM. Like they want to be the CEO of their brand, right? They want to be meeting the consumers where they want to play. They want to be sort of evangelizing their products. Like they just don't get a chance to do that. And I think a lot of that comes down to the operational burden of marketing and this sort of explosion of content. So a lot of my focus is on like, as solutions, how do we sort of unburden the brand, right? How do we actually take on as the agency more of that responsibility for getting those things over the line without necessarily having to create so much admin, right? And it sounds like it's a really unsexy part of it. Like I'd much rather like be focusing on the creativity and the actual execution of the production. But sometimes we get in our own way, you know? So a lot of my time is spent about consulting with clients, figuring out where those handoffs and handshakes are, where those pain points are. And I think that operational AI presents us with quite a unique opportunity to sort of streamline a lot of that, you know? So it's a fascinating space.
But it's not really the sexy stuff, is it?
It is not the sexy stuff, no, but it's the one unifying thing that a lot of our clients have problems with. And it's really difficult to solve it because it's at the cornerstone of the problem is human resistance a little bit to change. Like I've gone through three different transformations this year and three of those clients have commissioned third-party technology stacks that have been designed to kind of encompass their full end-to-end marketing ecosystem. Three of those things have failed, right? They're not things that we're managing, but they're things that we are beholden to. We have to use these tools. And a big part of the reason that they fail is because you either don't get the team on the ground involved in the discovery, right? Or you don't take them on the journey of change. And there's this natural sort of resistance between global and local. And a lot of my time is spent with global and local clients and trying to build the bridges between them. I think a lot of the time the perception is that global's a hammer and local's a nail and everybody needs to be whacked, you know, so.
Do any of your team at the agency, do they involve you in those conversations using Gen AI, not just the operational AI, when it comes to solving problems on production?
Yeah, we are finding more and more that, especially when it comes to workflow design, being able to, one of the interesting things about AI is that like, as you build a bigger context, right, you bring in more of the brand's ways of working, more of the interviews with the stakeholders, more of the examples of decks that they present or data that they have. The cool thing about AI is that the ability to connect the dots that maybe we don't see is actually really insightful, and it can kind of find some interesting white space and highlight sort of pros and cons of different approaches and solutions. So we're using it more and more to kind of battle test solutions before we present them back to the client so that we can look across all of that context. And I think that that's creating some very different conversations than we would have had historically with clients.
What are you doing that's better and smarter than the other holding groups or other kind of agencies?
That's like the $1 million question, Pat, because I think if we knew that, we'd probably win every pitch. But
I had to ask.
Do you know what I think about Dentsu? So I spent some time in Japan at the start of the year, and what struck me was just the heritage of Dentsu is just phenomenal. You know, 125 years. And in that 125 years, they'd had like, I think it was like six CEOs or something crazy. And they'd all been in tenure for like 20 years or something crazy. And they'd all had a moment that drove some form of like first in the industry, some sort of transformation in the industry. And so there's that heritage and getting that heritage sort of traveling west, that east to west thing, I think is really unique. A lot of other holding companies really struggle to break through in APAC and Japan. So I think that's really unique to Dentsu. But I also think the other part of it is that Dentsu, it's got a little bit of that sort of Japanese integrity. They're very transparent with the clients as well. And I think that actually resonates in a moment where things are a little bit fuzzy. I think Dentsu sort of stands out there. And it's just a really enjoyable company to work for, I'll be honest with you. Like the people are phenomenal. So I think they genuinely want to do good. Like it's something about that, which I find quite admirable, you know.
Some critics argue that the rise of AI risks homogenizing creativity, to how some data did.
Yes.
And in one of my last podcasts with Nick Manning, who's our kind of a media guru in the industry, he says that we have potentially learned how to make bad advertising cheaper and quicker.
Yes.
Do you concur with that?
I saw that quote when you guys were posting it, and I couldn't agree more. You know, it's sort of scaling mediocrity, aren't we?
How do you avoid that then?
You have to have intentional human friction. Right. Because for me, from a creative perspective, like the best ideas are the ones where you zig and not zag, right? That famous saying, right? But like you have to have some form of intentional human friction to find a way of finding a white space, finding the curveball idea. Like AI doesn't do that. It sort of averages across all of the ideas, yeah? And it's that human intuition to look at a creative idea or a brief from a client and go, oh my God, this would be a great like left field idea. And it's that's a really difficult thing for an AI to kind of model that behavior, because literally it's predicting the next token, right? And that next token is based on a data set that is just the average of everything. So for me, that human friction, we talk about this a lot as part of our technology stack, is like, where do we want to create intentional human friction? And that I think is really the unlock when you talk about creativity.
So in the business of creating content faster and cheaper, which is what all clients want, we're actually in the process downstream, the stuff that you're doing, where does AI actually genuinely help? And where is it still misunderstood?
I can tell you definitely where it's misunderstood. I think that in the early days, scale was like this sort of utopia of AI, but we weren't acknowledging how deterministic this thing was, right? That the repeatability of it was just not there, and it still isn't there. You know, we deal with automotive clients, and a lot of them are trying to use AI on their vehicles, and all of a sudden their vehicles don't look like their vehicles anymore, right? They're missing a hubcap, or they're missing a logo, or they're missing a shut line somewhere. And I think it's that level of nuance that clients have probably been oversold on. And I think that we owe it to our clients to not oversell those solutions when we know that they can't achieve the end results that they're expecting, because otherwise what ends up happening is that cost just ends up going back into the pot somewhere, right? You know, you make an AI image and then you've got to go back into post and fix it. Well, you've not really made any savings, right? So I think there's a lot of challenges with the repeatability of these systems that we're building and the predictability of these systems that we're building. So I think actually in content production, we've got a ways to go before content at scale becomes a real thing. Now, that goes back to our point about mediocrity, right? You're just scaling mediocrity by producing 100 different ads. A lot of our conversations with clients at the moment are about not doing that, right? Because not only are you scaling mediocrity, frankly, the media teams can't traffic 100 ads. There's very little precedent to review and approve 100 ads, right? When you've got a brand marketeer that's already saturated in their day, they can't approve 100 ads. Media team can't traffic 100 ads, right? There's a lot of work associated with that. So I think that that's some of the challenges with AI and its creating, and we've got to find solutions for those. I think where it's genuinely helping, it's helping in the process pieces, right? It's allowing our teams to refocus their attention on deeply understanding the brand, deeply understanding the strategy, better understanding the audience, right? Like making sure that we're writing better quality copy, not necessarily using AI to write copy, but producing more variations that we can look across and test, right? Or more variations of an image that we can look across and say, okay, we've got more mood boards that we can present more ideas, right? Because a lot of the time clients, they don't know what they want when they submit the brief, and they actually do want to see a spectrum of different ideas. And I think sometimes that's where it actually helps, is almost like in the pre-production phase of coming up with the ideas. But again, you still need that like intentional human friction in that process to filter out all the rubbish, you know?
I saw an amazing stat the other day that over 90% of all AI initiatives fail.
I probably think it's higher.
I think more than that.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Go for it. The big question is, how does a client avoid screwing it up?
Yes. I think, I'll be honest with you, I think the RFP process is really detrimental, because what's happening there is
procurement people, they all love that.
It's both the procurement piece And it's also the premise of the RFP, right? Because what's happening is you're given a finite moment in time to make that lasting impression. And oftentimes that can come in through the lens of like overpromising, or through the lens of, you know, making big, bold statements, or putting commercial models in front of people that aren't attainable. And I think that like also the friction internally, like procurement driven RFPs are really challenging because it's basically a race to the bottom at that point, and it doesn't prioritize creativity. It doesn't prioritize the things that we know differentiate a brand, right? When you want to build a brand, you don't just want $1,050 ads, right? Like, it's not how you're going to do it. So I think that we've got a real problem as an industry, and I don't think this is novel, right? We've talked about this for decades.
Let's dig a little bit deeper into this conversation because, you know, obviously we see a lot of RFPs as well. But from your perspective, what does a great RFP look like?
I think a great RFP is a consultation, right? Is more consultative. It's more about them saying, this is us as a brand. This is where we want to go. How do we get there, right? Like, we know our brand best. You know how to advertise our brand best. How do we do this together, right? And it's very rare for that to be issued like that, right? Because ultimately you're trying to compare apples to apples. And that, I think, in creating this sort of like baseline across all of the different people that are responding, you're actually losing probably some of the innovative thinking sometimes. Like, everybody's trying to respond to this RFP and they're trying to nail all of these points, but sometimes you just really need a left field idea. And also, I think procurement and brand are far too far apart. You can tell when an RFP is a procurement driven RFP, and you can tell when it is a brand driven RFP. And 75% of the RFPs we respond to are procurement driven RFPs. And so I think that this structure comes back to the whole CMO CFO relationship, doesn't it, a little bit?
The RFPs that I've been involved in the past, the ones that I really, really love is where you have very, very early opportunity to build a rapport with a potential client, right? So you get in the room and it's the chemistry. And if you have a great chemistry with a client, everything else is fixable.
Yeah, completely. We did one with a client and it took 7 months on the client, and it was probably one of the best RFP processes. And you didn't mind that it took so long because you're exactly right. One of the first things they did was they brought everybody into the room and did some chemistry sessions. And I thought it was just a really beautiful way of starting out, because it actually made you want to go that extra mile every single time because you'd already built that chemistry with them. So rather than sort of innovating in isolation, you kind of had this, like, you knew what they wanted. You understood what their pain points were. It was really fascinating. One of the quotes from that RFP, they had a real problem with like global to local visibility of assets. And what the CMO had said was, we need to pivot our audiences into new products. And unfortunately, the local markets are incentivized to sell products that just sell, right? Now, those products aren't the new products. And therefore, what happens is we can't see what they're selling in those local markets. And it's really difficult for us to pivot the brand into new audiences. And she said, so this brilliant quote, she's like, we get on a plane and we fly to a local market, and the only time we know what they're serving up is when we get off the plane and we get whacked with a cookie and we see an ad from our brand, right? And then they basically realize that what we're selling in that local market is not the new product, right? So I was like, this is a perfect problem statement, right, for a lot of brands. So that kind of really framed the whole pitch that we responded to. It was like, how do we become the bridge between global and local? And because we'd have that chemistry session where she had said these things, we were actually able to respond in kind, you know?
A couple of years ago, sustainability was a non-negotiable,
yes,
right? It really was.
Yeah.
It seems to have just disappeared. I mean, you know, AI isn't in reality a sustainable production methodology at all, right? Think about all the energy to power those data farms and the water needed to cool them all off. And, you know, I've got a couple of stats. By 2030, data centers supercharged by AI are projected to consume around the same as the entire current electricity consumption of Japan.
It's wild.
Right? Yeah. AI's global water demand has been projected to reach 4.2 to 6.6 billion cubic meters by 2027. That's roughly equivalent to half the UK's annual water withdrawal. I mean, that's nuts, right?
Yes. Yeah.
But this subject gets no airtime right now, particularly around the conversation around AI. What's your view about this? Because I have a passion for sustainability. We won the award, yes, for best practice in sustainable production a couple of years ago. And, yeah, it doesn't figure on the radar for a lot of clients right now.
We're in a really interesting position, Pat, because of the Tag business. So Tag is actually split into, not really split, but they have two sides of the business, as I'm sure you know. They've got the content production piece, which is a lot of the where the AI is sort of surfacing. We also have the channel activation and sourcing piece, which is all of the physical media, right? So in-store, point of sale, that's up. And actually, we've got a brilliant sustainability director, Emily Stolarczyk. It's her job to surface sustainability in the organization. And it's a constant topic of conversation specifically for us because of that side of the business, right? We're also looking at Dentsu. You know, I talked about integrity earlier. They believe that actually it's really important for us to reduce that carbon footprint. So we actually have quite a lot of initiatives internally looking at our scope 3 emissions, looking at how we're using AI, how do we quantify the impact of AI on production. So we are doing a lot of work in that space. I definitely think it's gone more internal, especially with, you know, sort of geopolitical issues, especially in the US. I think things have the foot has been taken off of the gas in general. And I think those conversations, it's similar to sort of DE&I conversations, they've sort of somehow sort of like quietened down and sort of disappeared, which is not a good thing. But internally, lots of that conversation happening. Now, the reality of how it manifests and how we monitor it, I think is key, because one of the things that lots of people are at lots of different stages of that process, right? And I think that as brands are starting to try to ramp up use of AI more, they don't really have that solid baseline understanding of what their emissions look like at the moment, right? So it's very difficult to create a baseline and compare where they were today versus where they will be tomorrow if they use AI, and therefore quantifying the delta between the two is quite difficult. So Emily does a ton of work with clients on just quantifying that baseline. And it's quite fascinating when you see some of those readouts.
Doesn't it come back to like some of the hygiene factors, right? Just avoid the wastage. You know, if you're going to do a scatter gun approach to making content, that's going to cause an issue. Why don't you just brief well, make only what you need?
Pat, have you ever seen a great brief? Because we talk about briefing all the time, and I reckon that 90% of the AI initiatives out there are probably briefing tools in some way, shape, or form, because we all know it's a problem. So what does a good brief look like to you? I'm so curious.
You're probably right. But some people do great briefs, and particularly, you know, a lot of our clients that we work with, we have to kind of educate them into that process as well. So we've added some extra really critical meetings that help that along. One of them is the production alignment meeting, which is long, long time before we get into choosing anything. It's a good practice.
It is. I love good brief.
Now, do you think we have a talent and skills issue in production today? Because there's still so many people who are working in a very old-fashioned way. What is it that these people can do to stay relevant?
I pontificate on this quite a lot. I kind of go back to like the consumer a little bit in terms of the skill gap. I think we've lost a bit of the focus on the consumer in advertising. Like, we can tell a great story, but you think about the way people consume content today, it's just so vastly different than the way that we talk about it in advertising circles. You know, I'm looking for a car at the moment, right? And I've been consuming these like 1 minute YouTube shorts of this guy that sort of basically does these quick pans around the vehicle and shows all the features, right? And for me, that's so different than the way that I would have done that years ago. And I think actually to stay relevant, you almost need to stay relevant to the consumer. You need to understand what their behaviors are. You need to understand how content is changing. You need to understand what's resonating. And it's not just about resonating in pockets with Gen Alphas and Gen Zs and influencers and TikToks and stuff like that. But like, it's actually understanding the changes in things like commerce. Like, we had a great question the other day about like, okay, the way that you buy a vehicle is changing. You know, Tesla, you can go onto their website and you can hit order on a vehicle. Well, that's very different than going into a dealership and spending 4 hours in there trying to get a test drive and like having to waste half your weekend trying to buy a car. I think that our teams need to stay closer to those consumer trends, those consumer habits, and bring those insights through to our clients, because that's how you remain relevant, right? Like, you think differently about how to drive engagement. on the flip side of that, there's the technology piece, right? Like that probably is more directly the question that you're asking. You've got to play. You've got to play with this stuff. Because one thing I will say is that, you know, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I probably hadn't ever played with an AI tool or technology. Today, I don't know what I'd do without it. Like, I use this tool called Whisperflow, and I'm sure everybody's heard about it, but I rarely type anymore on my computer. I just talk to my computer all the time. And it gives me these crazy stats at the end of the week. Like, today you spoke 150,000 words or something like obscene. But that gives me so many insights. And you've got to play with this stuff.
But stuff needs to be made.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
So ultimately, there needs to be a producer. Right?
Yes.
To make this stuff.
Yes.
What in your mind makes a great producer today? Is it having the skills to be able to make all of these different types of assets? Is it
a good question.
Someone who has the great human skills to corral a number of troops? What makes a great production person?
Some of the best producers that I've worked with, you know, production's hard, right? Like, it's actually quite difficult in the sense that, you know, you can be working long hours, right? You can get last minute changes. The best producers I've ever worked with are the people that can keep that energy up, keep that morale up, keep those feedback changes coming in, right? And everybody's really positive and excited about it, because we do our best work when we have a passion, right? Like, I will say, like, some of the best jobs I've ever done are when they've actually been free jobs, because you're just so invested. And those producers that are on those, like, they keep that momentum going, they keep that morale up, they keep that energy high, they're on top of everything, right? Like, you don't always feel like you're sort of fighting the client, you feel like you're in lockstep with the client, you know, and everybody's sort of trucking towards the same goal. We had this fantastic lady, Jess Pirrick, when we first moved over to Taylor James in the US, and she was just a bundle of energy, and like, oh, I loved working with her. So to just, yeah, just really good energy.
You think a great producer is really now, with all of the stuff that a producer needs to handle, you think they're really the third member of a creative team?
I think that's an interesting question. I think if you're talking purely about like creative and production working together, yes, I think that them translating that creative into the production deliverables and how they're the interface between the creative teams and the production teams is so critical. I mean, all of the agencies that we always used to work with, that producer to producer relationship was absolutely critical. You know, as an independent, we worked with every single agency in the world, and it was always those two producers that were on either side of the fence that were absolutely critical to making sure that idea came to life in the right way and that nothing was missed. So yeah, I would say that. I do think that from what I'm seeing, there is a third wheel now, right, that's coming in, which is the media teams. And those producers, I think it's really difficult for them to understand media as well. Like, media is just a different world.
So this is like a fulfillment producer, somebody who's
it's like an
just
integrated
making
producer.
Sure.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Yeah. Like, how do you now suddenly, it's not just the creative idea, it's not just how you produce it. It's like, what's the audience strategy? Yeah. What channels are they buying across? What's the historic performance? Like, that's a lot for somebody to absorb, and that's tough.
Yeah. Look, we're in Cannes next week.
Yes.
Right? Both of us. And when this goes live, we'll have been there, done it, and got the t-shirt and a couple of glasses of rosé, I guess, along the way. What are you actually hoping for next week? And, you know, how will you know if your trip there has been successful?
Pat, that is...
Apart from meeting up with me, of course, right?
But actually, that's probably going to be one of the highlights, you and Mr. Sikorsky, yeah. I have a little bit of a love-hate relationship with Cannes, if I'm really open. I love the people. I love meeting the people. I love seeing kind of what the latest trend is, right? But I almost think it's lost its focus on creativity a little bit. We were just doing our review the other day of all of the entries that we've made at Dentsu, and we have this thing called reverse media schedules. And it's basically like, we were talking about sustainability earlier, which is the reason I was thinking about it. So it's this idea that like, when you see a piece of rubbish in the world, like, it's got a brand logo on it, and that's like the worst advertising for the brand in the world. So they'd actually basically paid the team to go out there using media dollars and pick up rubbish, right? And remove it from the world. Like, to me, that's the stuff I want to see at Cannes, right? Like, that's the sort of like it's all about sustainability. It's all about brand good. It's all about like, and I feel like we've lost that a little bit because you get sort of like overwhelmed with the AI hype, right? And I want to just see great ideas that move me, you know?
Do awards still matter?
I think they do. I think they do because I think it's without the awards, the recognition for great work, it disappears. And I think that it's really important that we recognize the value of great creativity. If we don't, what are we striving to achieve? Like, otherwise it's just like, how efficiently did you buy a load of media? How much content did you make? It doesn't matter, right? Like, unless it actually moved somebody and made a difference in the world and it drove some sort of, you know, outcome for the brand, I think you only get that when you really critically look at some of these things.
Pitching is expensive. Right? We've had this conversation before and agencies have talked about it a lot, about how much time and money is invested in a pitch.
Yeah.
It's incredibly time consuming. Sometimes it can take forever.
Yeah.
And, you know, if there's loads and loads of suppliers, vendors, agencies involved in this pitch, then, you know, your chance for success is pretty small.
Yeah.
And sometimes a lot of the thinking is given away for free as well. So yeah. What's the right way for a CMO and their procurement partner to choose a production or creative partner today? Is it to have a smaller pitch list? Should they be paying for the privilege of having companies on the pitch list? How should this work in your mind?
You've got some good questions, Pat. These are thought provoking. I think the industry's had a challenge with the pitch for the longest time because they feel like they're giving away some of their IP, right? Whether it's a creative territory or whether it's a process or whether it's a technology that they're showing, it's challenging. I think that the way that CMOs should evaluate pitches is based on a creative response, right? Or a production response to a specific ask. I think it's one thing to go through all these operations, all these commercials, all of these sustainability things, or like all of the ancillary documents that we supply that justify who we are and why we're an advertising agency. I think it comes down to the quality of a response to a genuine brief. That should be the evaluation criteria that weights highest. And a lot of the times these days, we aren't seeing creative responses as part of these RFPs. Like the ones, funnily enough, I would say the ones that we win more often are when there is a creative response. So I can think of Audible last year, a couple of years back, we responded to them and it was all about the creative response. And our deck just looked different because it was all framed around their brand, their idea. How do we bring that to life, right? Sometimes when you don't have that, it's just a creds deck, you know? So I think for CMOs and procurement to be closer together, this has to all be framed around a reality.
I agree. Look, I have a theory. You might have read that thing that I posted a couple of weeks ago about production might become the operating system for marketing, or a more important operating system for marketing.
I think you might be right, Pat, if I'm honest.
Did you read that?
I did, yeah.
It potentially has the opportunity to join all the dots of all the different platforms, yes, and systems, you know, creative, yes, production, media, data, workflows, DAMs, commerce, and performance as well. And, you know, production could be the thing that joins it all up. Now, you know, I was kind of went into that writing it slightly controversially saying that, but it could be, right? If people get it right. And I think I'm seeing that happen in a lot of the holding companies and agencies who understand where it's all headed. What's your view on that?
Do you know why I agree with you on that? I think about this a lot as well, Pat. Creative and media, it's actually quite a subjective thing, right? Production is a very physical thing. You end up with something you can physically hold at the end of it, right? You got an asset. With a media, you might have a media plan. With a creative, you might have creative territory. But those things are still incredibly subjective. Whereas I think for production, it's a very physical thing. That's why I think it's very real. And that's why I think it can be the glue that binds a lot of these things together. Because really, it's the result of the output. Now, we've always been at the bottom of the food chain from a production perspective. But we're the only part of the food chain that actually delivers something, right? Like physically. So I think that's why it's the conduit for many things. And that's why I would say it's we're seeing holding companies make sure that they build those bridges between production and media and production creative. And
what's the one thing that you wish every CMO understood about modern production?
I want them to see the passion that goes into the production from the teams that do the work. I don't think they see it. I've been pitching for a brand all weekend, and that team put in their heart and soul into that pitch. And the work was just fantastic, but they did it because they loved the brand. Like, and I don't think we evangelize that enough, you know.
You could have any job in the world tomorrow. What would it be?
I always wanted to be a police dog handler, Pat, if I'm honest. I mean, that was my, like, do you know what? I'd applied when I didn't get the job at Taylor James. I'd applied to become a police dog handler, and I didn't get into the force in the UK. And I was such a, like, again, maybe it's fate. Maybe I was never meant to be that, and I was always meant to be in production. But that's what I really wanted to do.
Your whole life is not in a straight line at all, is it? It's like a zigzag all over the place. And I kind of think that's what makes life interesting.
Yeah, I think it's beautiful. Now, that's why I love advertising. It's no 2 days are the same.
One of the things that no one knows about you,
yes,
is that you were nationally ranked in the UK, right?
Yes.
as a table tennis player,
yes.
Nationally ranked. Yeah. Was that like ranked like 2,000, 3,000?
No. I was in the top 200. It was.
Oh,
I mean,
wow.
you'd
okay,
actually
good.
Think there's quite a few people in the UK that play table tennis.
Yeah.
We started up this coaching school in Southampton, and it started out with 8 kids in a church, and I was one of the coaches. And in 2 years, we had 110 kids. One of them actually went on to become number one ranked in the UK. So we used to go around and play all these tournaments, and I'd go with the kids, I'd play the tournaments, my ranking would go up as well, and these kids were like beating me like left, right and center, and they're like 10 years old, right? But it was just it was just so much fun to see them progress. But yeah, that was a highlight. I used to play with you probably know Matthew Syed, who's obviously a famous psychologist as well as a table tennis player. He set up a table tennis club on the Isle of Wight, so when I was over there making computer games, I played at his table tennis center as well. It was a good time.
You still play?
I wish I could. No, unfortunately not.
I'll give you a game.
There we go. We'll find a table in Cannes.
Fantastic. Look, Mark, it's been such a pleasure to have you here. I do have one final question to ask you. It's the one we always ask.
Yes.
To finish off, what's your favourite ad of all time?
Oh, you know what?
And you can't have made it.
No, I didn't make it. I wish I'd made it, I'll tell you that. I love The Man on the Moon, the John Lewis ad. And the reason I love it is just because I think it is a beautiful ad that makes you feel something, right? And we're in an age where, like, we're so disposable with the content that we create, whereas I like an ad that makes me stop and think and get a little bit goosebumps, right? But also, like, the craft of that ad, like the music in it, like the cinematography, it is just the story. Like, it's like everything came together in that advertising process to make that ad, and it worked perfectly. And I think it's beautiful.
Thank you so much. Look, I'm going to post that up on the podcast website so you can have a look at Mark's favorite ad of all time. And Mark, oh my God, that was just so much fun.
I had a good time.
See you next week.
Yes, indeed. Indeed.
Today we talked to Mark Knowles, a true innovator in global production and technology, and just a bloody nice guy. To find out more about the podcast, head to theprodcast.com, where you'll find details on all my guests, links to their favorite ads, and full transcriptions of every episode. If you have any comments, questions, or feedback, email us at podcast@murphycobb.com. I'm Pat Murphy, CEO of Murphy Cobb. Connect with us on LinkedIn or Instagram. All the links are in the show notes, and please like us on the favorite platform. Thanks again to Mark, our wonderful team behind the scenes, and our production partners at What Goes On Media. See you next time.